Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's plenty of rain. But I think we're going to dry out just a little bit. I think the temperatures are going to be just about right for your tomatoes here over the next week or two. That's going to be nice. And we'll have lots of lawn diseases to talk about, as we always do, as we always will. They're never ending, and no matter what I say, they won't go away. It's just one of the things of having a lawn. All these things are going to happen. But, you know, I got some stories to tell. Some pretty interesting stories to tell this week. And I can't get over the fact, because there is this hum going on in the background. It reminds me of a distant roar from a stadium. When people are, you know, if you're away from a stadium and you hear that roar of the crowd, it's like that, but it's constant. It's all the time. And I can't say it's annoying. It's just sort of like the wheels of life just grinding away. And you just expect life to have a sound. And if life had a sound, I guess this is pretty much how I imagine life having a sound. This sort of roar of these wheels turning. And those wheels turning are, of course, the cicadas, the periodic cicadas. They are just a force to be dealt with. We're seeing them in some parts of the states and not in other parts of the states. It's kind of bizarre. I was in Birmingham last week for a meeting. There were no cicadas at all. I can't even fully explain why there were no cicadas there at all. We do know that in places that are dominated by pines, or that were once dominated by pines, like longleaf forest, like Splinter Hill, like most of Baldwin and Mobile counties, you're not going to see those cicadas. But up in the Red Hills, boy, Monroe County, just huge. And then north of Birmingham, just huge. Why not in Birmingham? Well, I think that says something about how the forest may have changed around Birmingham over the years. Isn't that interesting? I'd love to hear from you, wherever you are, if you're hearing the cicadas. Like to know where people are hearing them, where they're not. So be sure to call in. But I have some thoughts about the cicadas. First off, I should tell you, because I hope we'll talk a little bit more about food this morning, I hope I've engaged David Hubbell soon enough that he'll actually be able to be on this morning. But let me tell you a little bit about our preferences for food. You know, everything that we've learned to eat, we accept that the grocery store has vetted it for us. And if it hasn't been vetted by whatever grocery store we're going to, Publix, we don't think it's edible, which is a bizarre thing to do, actually. And grocery stores determine what's edible based on what's convenient for them and what they can most easily put in plastic and ship across the country and make a profit on. And yet, this is how we determine our appetites. Cicadas, just be prepared, have long been thought of as a primary and delightful and even preferred food source when they occur. Ask the birds. Boy, you want to know why the birds are singing right now? They got a mouthful. But if they get that mouthful down, boy, they are just as happy as they can be. You know, the fish are out there. I'll tell you the story. So we decided we're going to try these, and some friends of mine who work at University of Alabama, John Abbott, who is the chief curator at University of Alabama Museums and a big expert on insects. And his wife, Kendra, who is an excellent photographer along with John, and who have produced the Book of Insects, the Princeton Field Guide to the Insects of North America. A great book, if you get it, produced by two folks here in Alabama. They came and they visited because they wanted to see this, and we determined, as I suspected, that there were three different, very different types of cicadas going on. We gave each of them names. One of them is a rather large with an orange belly and makes a very low whirling sound. And that low whirling sound is the sound that I'm hearing in the background now everywhere. It just is constant, a constant roar. That's really cool. We call those the mellow yellows. They're big. They don't fly. You can hold them in your hand. Hold all of them in your hand, but you can hold these in your hand, and they're just very quiet, and they sit there. They won't make a sound until you release them and put them back, and then they wait for you to go away, and then they'll start singing again. But they're the mellow yellows. They're not very active. There's another group of cicadas out there right now in the hatch out that have black bellies, and they're much smaller. And they have a really interesting zap, 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 zap sound. That's very different than that low sound. It's much higher pitched, and boy, are they active. You grab them in your hands, and they just they make all kinds of noises. They want to be released. We've called those the Black Barts, pugnacious little fellows. There's another group that we didn't give a name to, and I decided to give a name to, but they're really cool. They have a sound that sounds like a weird, complex jazz drum roll. It's like, if you've ever heard those weird jazz drum rolls, it sounds like the sound's being sucked up out of the drums, and then it intensifies as it gets to the end of it. That's what it sounds like. Weird, rhythmic sounding drum rolls. Of course, we call those the Ginger Bakers. If you don't know who Ginger Bakers are, go look it up. There's three of them out there. They're making all kind of noise. So we decide, we're going to find out what this is about. We're going to eat them. And we did. And they were quite delicious. We prepared them, pulled off the wings. I don't know that you need to do that. But Kendra decided we would pull off the wings, which we did. And we fried them up, and, they were quite delicious. Really, really very delicious. A little bit like mushrooms. A little bit like mushrooms with a green quality, too, that was very pleasant. Kendra says it's like a mild spinach. I guess that's sort of what I taste. But it's a little different, but it's very greens, like much like eating greens, along with mushrooms, and very sweet on the backside. Not at all unpleasant. It sort of reminds me of eating shrimp properly cooked. And if you think that there's something weird about eating invertebrates, well, don't eat shrimp, my friends. Don't eat crawfish. Don't eat lobsters. Don't eat crabs. It's all part of that sort of same group. There's not much difference in them, really. No difference in it. It's quite good. Really interesting. And I will, I think when this hatch out occurs again in, 2037, I'm going to try it with a little balsamic. I think it'll be better that way. Just some things to think about while cicadas are hatching out. Another observation about cicadas, which we won't have fully time to tell, but we went fishing during this cicada outbreak. I didn't go fishing. I was the guide. I was there to show somebody what this river was like, and this was when they wanted to see it, and I did my duty, and I paddled, and I'll tell you about that, what it's like fishing during a cicada outbreak. Kind of really interesting, and also really interesting insight into how we think about the world and how we treat the world. We'll talk about that when we come back, but give us a call this morning, 251-343-0106, 251-343-0106. Give us a call this morning. I'm really interested if you have heard cicadas where you are.
Have you ever seen peaches?
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back, Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. It's really interesting to think about how we deal with nature. Here's another story. And the cicadas are really making me think about this. I didn't make the cicadas. It's not my fault they're here. If anybody asked my permission, I'd say, and if my permission mattered, I'd say, sure. Sure. Bring them on. But it's just a really interesting part of life. It's like, you know, it's like rain. It's like heat. It's like lightning. It's like sunshine. It's like cicadas. And we have our usual cicadas, the annual cicadas. They actually live a long time underground, too, 3, 4, 5 years. But some group of them is always emerging. And so we have the big green annual cicadas. And I actually haven't seen any of the big green annual cicadas yet. They usually tend to come out a little later. But these are the periodic cicadas, the periodic locust, as they're sometimes called, even though they're not really what we would commonly call locust. The people who decided what language we would speak in this country came from a part of the world where there's not a lot of words for nature, because there ain't much nature there. It's kind of interesting. There's not a lot of diversity in those places, so they would take words that seemed familiar, like locust, and they would try to translate it into what they were seeing here, and it just didn't work at all. So locust instead of cicada, it's fine. But these are, I actually like the name cicada, don't you? What a cool name. And it almost has that sort of shimmering, kind of rhythmic staccato sound that a lot of those cicadas make. Makes it really interesting. The word. But I'm thinking about cicadas, so I have to, I owe some things to, wants to go fishing during a cicada outbreak to see what it's like. And he's a big fly fisher person, got his big fly rod. And so I say, I can take you to where this happens. And I owe him, so I do it. And it's a great trip. We enjoy it. The cicadas are, it's raining initially, but when the rain subsides, the cicadas come back out, and they're just, it's just shimmering. The whole woods are shimmering with them. I mean, the trees are shimmering with them. The cicadas are falling into the water everywhere you look. And the water's stirring with fish. And I take him to the place where I know he's always going to catch a fish, and where I take people just to make them feel good. And I say, put your line there, and he catches two smallmouth, fat as they can be. I mean, just stuffed with cicadas. He's so impressed. He's really excited. And we're going to go fishing some more. So he didn't use a cicada bait, but he's going to use now a cicada fly that was designed to look like a cicada. And it does. I mean, if it was in the water and everything else was still, I would say, oh gosh, that's a cicada. Well, it does, but there was one problem. There were cicadas all around it, and all of those cicadas were fluttering their wings and stirring up the water. And the cicada was just kind of sitting there, and nothing was hitting it. And he said, I can't understand. I mean, it looks so much... You know, it's interesting how we think about fishing has become like our eating habit, sort of a what's on the shelf process. And we one of the reasons why we've gotten so involved in tying flies and creating flies is that it was harder for us to actually go and catch flies. I don't know. That's really the origin of fly fishing, is that the bait that was used to catch fish was harder to catch. And so we decided, well, we'll do it artificially. We'll do it artificially. But there was never anything better, about those artificial baits than there was about the natural baits that the fish were going for. And so I'm thinking, gosh, you know, if we could just design a fly, I'm telling him, that the wings would flap, and if it could just make that little buzzing sound as the wings are flapping in the water, and if we could do that and make a fly like that, that it would be, I bet we'd catch fish like crazy. Just a thought. You know, put a cicada, put the real thing on a hook. We'd have caught fish like crazy. We would have still caught fish all day long. It's funny how we do those things, isn't it? You know, it's just, if you're out fishing, it's really nice to think about real bait sometimes and to think about how you're using it. I think it's also, we do the same thing in gardening. So we go to the store and I get asked about, oh, well, what kind of soil do I get at the store? And is this, and I got to have earthworm poop, and I got to buy a bag of earthworm poop at the store to make my garden grow better. And I think, you know, all you got to do is ring the dinner bell for the worms, and you're going to have worms. And to make your topsoil, all you need is organic matter, the leaves in your yard. That's what makes topsoil. You don't need to go to the store to buy it. And we've created all of these artificial soils, artificial baits, artificial. Why? Sometimes it's good just to think about, here's the tools we have in hand. This is what works. The fish are going after the cicadas because the cicadas are good to eat. They are, actually. I'll have to say, they're sweet. I mean, those smallmouth bass, I'll tell you, they thought they were the sweetest things in the world. They had bellies that looked like, you know, they looked like they'd been sitting on the couch drinking beer and watching football. You know what that looks like. It's amazing. Amazing. So we can talk more about cicadas if you'd like. I hope you do want to. I'm going to be answering your questions too. Rusty sent me a picture from last week. This week, he said, I'll take singing frogs and lightning bugs over cicadas. Nothing wrong with singing frogs and nothing wrong with the lightning bugs, and they're getting started up good. But I like the cicadas too. I like the cicadas. And the frogs are liking the cicadas as well, I can tell you. And the turtles. I mean, everything out there is eating the cicadas, including me. If you want any information about how to prepare cicadas, I'm more than happy to tell you about it. More than happy to tell you about it. All right, so you can give us a call this morning. And we'll be answering. Rusty, I'm going to it's Rumex. I think this one is more closely related. Well, it is. An amaranth. I think Amaranthaceae is a beet. But this is actually maybe more closely related to beets. I'll look it up, but it's Rumex, it's sorrel, wild sorrel, dock. Those are all names we give to this group of plants in Rumex. And the leaves are quite tasty. They're sour, but interesting. Sour in a really fun way, in a really good way. You might try them. They're better when they're young. They're better when they're young than when they're older. But, Rusty, that's what we're looking at there. All right. Let's see here. Have only heard many frogs south of Fairhope. Yeah, you know, so it is interesting where these cicada noises come from. And again, Fairhope, it tells you something that you're not hearing. You're not hearing the cicadas in Fairhope. It tells you something about how Fairhope was. Fairhope was not a city of live oaks originally. Fairhope was founded, oh gosh, I don't want people to forget this, though it may only break their hearts to know it. Fairhope was founded as a city, as a resort city, very early in the 19th century and as a utopian community, but it was founded where it was, in the middle of a longleaf pine savanna, where there were no live oaks, very few live oaks, probably only a few down by the water. But the idea was that the longleaf pine savanna was a healing place, and it was in many ways. So people who had asthma didn't experience their asthma problems in those longleaf forests. We'll come back and talk about why. But places with pines, no cicadas. No periodic cicadas. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. I'm trying not to pay attention to the roar of the cicadas that I'm hearing at the research center where I work. They're all around. A lot of broadleaf trees here. That's what the cicadas like. Is they like broadleaf trees. I'm trying to figure out if they have a certain preference. Do they like maples? Do they like oaks? Do they like hickories? I can't tell. My sense is that they like the trees that are fast growing. But I could be wrong. I could be wrong. I really haven't figured this out. But Fairhope, and to go back to that story about Fairhope, which is an interesting story, won't have cicadas. Won't have the periodic cicadas. It may have some of the other cicadas, but it won't have the periodic cicadas, the big 13-year, because it was a longleaf savanna. It had plenty of other nice things, like frog sounds, which have their own rhythm and their own beauty, and those frog sounds will be happening here already. Now, there's a silence around Fairhope because we've wiped out most of the longleaf, and we've replaced it with whatever we've replaced it with, lawns, which give us all sorts of grief. But that was the story of Fairhope, and that's why there are no cicadas around Fairhope, is because it was a longleaf forest. And that's no bad thing, having a longleaf forest. I guess I would choose longleaf over cicadas myself, if we could have it. It's nice to have both, though. Nice to have both. Let's see, Rumex. So we were talking about dock. Rusty, that is sour dock. Oh, God, what are some of the other names? But it's sorrel. It's, and you asked me if it was an amaranth, and it does kind of look like it. It does look a little bit like amaranth, but it's not. It's Polygonaceae, which is, what else would be in that family? Buckwheat. It's the buckwheat family. It's more closely related to buckwheat, but different. Dock, really cool plant, really a useful native plant, and it shows up a lot, and people would eat it. David, thank you. You're going to call in about 10:15. David, I have been running, and I'm sorry I missed your earlier message. David Hubble's going to call in. We're going to talk about food. David, I'm going to talk to you about thistles. I'm thinking about thistles. They're beginning to develop, and I know they're getting to a stage where they're actually harvestable, I think, in many cases. So we're going to talk a little bit about thistles this morning, too, David, if you don't mind. And we might talk about cicadas. I don't know what you think about this, but I think we should talk about cicadas as well, which are a very Louisiana thing, particularly North Louisiana. The Great hatch out there. What else we got going on? Oh, got a message from, who sent me that message this morning? Barry sent me a picture of a plant that's producing a red flower. He said he planted seeds, and he can't remember what it was he planted. They're 4 o'clocks, right? Does that ring a bell, Barry? 4 o'clocks. Mirabilis Jalapa. 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 Jalapa, however you want to say it. 4 o'clocks. Is there another name for 4 o'clocks besides 4 o'clocks? That's a common name. I don't think so. 4 o'clocks is what we're going to call it. The flowers open in the afternoon, late in the afternoon, hence 4 o'clock. And they're really cool through the evening hours. And then they furl up again. 4 o'clocks, kind of a famous plant. That's what you got there, Barry. And they're nice to have. They're certainly nice to have. They can be weedy in some places, but they're not too weedy. They're not too bad. You got to watch them. They will come up if they like where they are. So there you go. All right. And wait until a different time. Good morning. Let's see, how have we got this? It's today. My parents gave us some purple iris, and I'm wondering whether it's better to plant them out now or pot them and wait until a different time to plant out. I would plant. It depends on where your parents are and what you mean by purple iris. I'll say that. And that's important to know. I think probably regardless, if they're our native iris group, if they're some of our native iris that like wet areas, you definitely want to go ahead and plant them out and keep them wet. They'll be fine. And so if it's just, but if they're European iris and your parents gave you those iris and they live much farther north where those purple iris grow well, say maybe as far north as Montgomery or even Evergreen, then it's a different story. I might even suggest keeping them in pots because they don't like our wet soils. And you're going to struggle with them anyway, and you're going to have to think really hard about where you put them because they're going to have a hard time. They're not going to do any better if you put them in the ground because we're coming up on a wet season. If you didn't think it was wet already, we'll soon be coming up on we will have a wet July. There's no reason to believe this July isn't going to be as wet as Julys are in South Alabama. So it'll be hard on those iris. So we need to know a little bit, John, about where those iris originally came from, where your parents are from, where they were growing them. And that will help me to know. And if they were growing them, and you can describe them a little bit too. If the leaves are stiff and bluish green and don't have any fold or bend to them, it kind of a silvery turquoise look to the leaves, those are probably European iris, and they're going to have a hard time. They're Eurasian iris. They're going to have a hard time, so we have to make specific provisions. If the leaves are taller and softer and don't have as much rigidity, it could be a native iris. Could well be, it's likely to be a native iris. So we need to figure that out so we'll know what to do with it. 1600s, I haven't heard of that. Is that right, Mr. Plott? Oh, good, I can't tell. So the question is the climate in Valparaiso, can we use the same planting wheel that we're using here in Mobile? Probably not, though there will be some similarities that you have to think about. I'll have to remember how far down Valparaiso is, but it's definitely far enough down that we're going to see some very different things. It's a good instruction. You'll do better with the planting wheel that I created for Mobile than you will with planting advice from New England. But even better is planting advice from Florida, where people have really thought about what it's like living where you are. You know, that is the thing about gardens. You got to know where you are, or you're not successful. You can't be successful. You can't build a garden in Mobile based on gardening advice from people in Minnesota, I can tell you. It just doesn't work. You can't even build a garden in Mobile based on gardening advice from people in Birmingham. And I would be cautious. I would be anybody from Huntsville who's taking advice from somebody who really only has ever gardened in Mobile and who really only understands Mobile. Oh, I tell you to be very cautious, because it just isn't going to work. It isn't going to work. So it's always about where you are. Always about where you are. Yeah, you know, so Mr. Plott says, and no bugs on Celeste Road. And yeah, and there wouldn't be. Celeste Road was another place where it was dominated by longleaf, even when I was a child. Really amazing how much longleaf pine there was there. Not a bunch of hardwoods like we've got now, but these guys would have had to have grown up over thousands of years with a broadleaf hardwood forest. And that's where we see the cicadas. I remember the coolest kid in grade school is the one who came in from PE with the most shells on their shirt. Yes, that is the annual cicadas, and that is absolutely cool. And right now, I will tell you, if you're a kid, there are so many shells out there, it's unbelievable. I mean, you could pick a 5-gallon bucket full of cicada shells in no time and take it to school. And I don't know. I mean, there's got to be some use for that many shells. I mean, the shell's the sort of exoskeleton. What is the word that John and Kendra used? Don't remember it. But at any rate, it's the exudium or something. It's basically their exoskeleton or their outer skin that they're shelling. They're breaking out of so that they can grow and get bigger and change form and fly. Those little shells are so cool, and they're probably, I don't know, they've got to be rich in chitin. They've got to be probably great for the lawn. If I had a 5-gallon bucket and I really wanted my tomatoes to do well, I think I might dump them on the tomato. Isn't that neat? Isn't that cool? Certainly I'd try it. All right. My dad, the purple iris, my dad brought them home from a school he taught at Mobile. They've been growing theater for several years now. Bloomed out right now in his yard, but the flowers on the ones we brought home have wilted down. Thanks, John in Irvington. John in Irvington, that looks like one of our native iris. So, yes, and the fact that it's been growing in Theodore, all is good. Put it in the ground now. It actually is really tolerant of wet soils. It will love July. It will grow very well through July, so give it that chance to get established through July. You'll have plenty of moisture. You got plenty of moisture now, right? I didn't check the forecast for this week. I think there are some dry days this week, but that's fine. You got plenty of moisture. You're way over. Your area is way over the normal rainfall, so the ground is nice and moist. These guys will like it just fine. Lots of organic matter. They like lots of organic matter. Nothing wrong with that. They will live in a dry site, but they're very tolerant of wet sites. So just one thing to think about. Really cool. That looks very much like a native purple iris. Put it in the ground. Put it in the ground. Johnny in Grand Bay, black cherries are loaded, pulling down their limbs. Lots of early girl tomatoes getting ripe. It's got some nice new potatoes. There it is. Planted from my old potatoes, planted in the leaves in February. Some have reached full size. Johnny in Grand Bay. Yeah, I think we're probably going to end up talking about black cherries this morning when David Hubble gets here after the hour. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Because everything you do on the phone, you know you got to go.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
David B. up in Birmingham now, Gardendale. Listen, David, that's a great idea. I think that there are a lot of ferns that can do better, and all ferns are going to like organic matter, so leaf mulch is great. That's perfect. They'll really thrive in that. So, you know, you want your soil to be reasonably good. I would go ahead and plant the ferns in the native soil that you've already got there that the hostas are in, and then just mulch it with leaves. What ferns? And we could have so much fern fun with native ferns if we could find them, if we could find them available. And it's just so hard to find. What you're going to find are Asian ferns, which is just weird. It's just weird. But Christmas fern will do fine there. And they'll be great if you can find those, what we call Christmas ferns. That's usually a native fern. Usually the name refers to a native fern. Christmas fern would be really good. Broad beach fern would be great there. Oh, it's a lot of fun. So you'll have fun with that, David. Good to hear from you. Let's see. What kind of tree is this on a central Mississippi farm? Central Mississippi property, I'm sorry, that someone is buying. And those are two good cues. The pictures helped. That is a deodar cedar. I will send you that. I will send you that message with it written out. It's a deodar. I'm going to write it here for you right now. A deodar cedar. Pretty sure that's what it is, and it would be typical of central Mississippi. It's not native. It's basically a northern Indian Himalayan cedar, and it does quite well in, doesn't do well in the really, really humid areas. I don't think it does as well in Mobile. I think there are more problems in Mobile with it. But as you get up to the central part of Mississippi, it was quite a popular tree for a long time. I rarely see it planted anymore, but it is an interesting tree. It's a very graceful tree, as I've heard it referred to. Deodar cedar is what you've got there. Let's see here. What else have we got that I haven't? What else we got? John sent me a message, and John's messages are always cursed to the point of being cryptic. But his message was Blanco spring garlic. I think John meant to, I don't know if that's a question. I didn't see any pictures with it. The pictures didn't come in, John. But I am very interested. I think what it means is that he grew the artichoke garlic. He grew an artichoke garlic called Blanco Aglio, or it's an Italian garlic, white garlic. I'm very interested to hear how it does, John. And so if you have pictures of it, I'd love to see it. Some of the artichoke garlics can do quite well places like Grand Bay, and some of them may not, so I'm really interested to hear. And if anybody grew any Creole garlic this year, I would love to hear your thoughts. You know, I keep hearing that Creole garlic does really well in humid, hot climates. It has not been my experience that it does. Now, I'm not sure I can explain why that is. I just don't know why that is, why I have had poor experience with it. But I keep trying it. I keep playing with it. If anybody's had any experience with it, and just in general, love to hear about your garlic experiences, how it went. Some people did really well. No, Amy sent me some really great pictures. One that Amy, I think, who did some great pictures of garlic. There it is. What to put under Satsumas as a mulch? Well, you know, Satsumas don't like a lot of heavy mulch. I use a mulch to keep the weeds down. That's good, though. They do cast a lot of shade, and they tend to keep the weeds down themselves. In many ways, satsumas do not like a heavy mulch. Figs love a heavy mulch. Bananas, heavy mulch. Oh, just mulch the stew out of them. They'll love it. They'll be great. Figs love it. But citrus don't as much. And so it's not easy to mulch them too much, but it's quite possible. And I think some people do it. There's another problem with citrus and mulch, and that is in winter, you really would prefer that there's no mulch underneath it at all. So, yeah, here's what I'm saying. What's the best mulch for citrus? Well, I think a mulch can help, as long as it's not too thick. I would put that mulch on in spring, and then let it break down and hope it all breaks down before winter. And then when winter gets here, I would rake whatever mulch is left out to the edge of the canopy so that you've got bare ground underneath that satsuma. That would be ideal because that bare ground will be better at releasing its heat. And that's the old thing that the Extension Service folks have told me for years and years. And in general, I find that to be true. I think it's probably true. I think there are probably some exceptions. I think there's some complications, and I don't think it's quite as simple as just that. But in general, pulling that mulch back in winter makes the tree a little bit hardier because the ground heat can be released really well. The one thing you do not want to do, and I guarantee this would be a mistake, is to put mulch on a citrus after midsummer, because it's not going to break down, and particularly if it's thick, and it's going to inhibit the ground heat moving into the canopy, and that's not what you want. So it's just a little thing to think about. Creole garlics have not done well for me either. Isn't that interesting? I don't know where people are getting this idea. Maybe they don't have a real understanding of hot and humid. I mean, after all, the guys writing this are from they're from eastern Washington State, which is about as dry and unhumid a place as you possibly could be in. And so I don't know where they're getting this idea, but I've had a real struggle with Creole garlics. And a lot of them are from places in Spain that get rain, but it tends to dry out later on. I don't know. It tends to dry out in summer. They tend to be wet winter places that dry out. But I don't know. We'll figure this out. But always good to hear this. So the ones that Tyler in Creola. Tyler says, the ones I've had success with are the turban garlics, Thai fire, red Janus, and lotus. And yet, those are the ones, lotus, blossom, Thai fire, Thai purple, those are the ones that have pretty well consistently done well for me. Red Janus, kind of iffy, but I've had okay luck with it a lot of years. But there's a lot of, and most of the ones that are really good for us are the turban garlics. Well, there it is. First hour gone. We're going to be back. David Hubble's going to be with us. I know we got lots of things to talk about. David is, you know, kind of an authority on eating along the Gulf Coast and Louisiana heritage. So we're going to be back and talk with David when we have a chance.
Cornbread and butter beans, and you cross the table.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We've been talking about lots of different things this morning. it's and garlic, because it's, you know, I think for a lot of you, it's time to be harvesting the garlic. If you get a window here, it's hard to harvest garlic. Just an observation. You may find a way around it, but it's messy to harvest garlic when the ground is super wet. Just thinking, you got to clean off all that mud, and it's just not as good. It's a little better to have it when it's dry. This is a tough year, right? Because it's been raining all the time. So I don't know that there's a time that it was going to be easy, but if you've got some dry weather next week and your ground dries out a little bit, for most of you who are growing the appropriate garlics, the garlics that do best, the turban garlics, I would go ahead and harvest them. And that's probably true throughout Alabama. Just generally throughout Alabama, if you let them go into the period of time deep into June when we start getting more rain, they're going to tend to resprout. Lots of crazy weird things happen. So look at your garlic, feel around, go ahead and pull it. So who sent me this? From Bill from Mobile. Some people have furniture in their dens. Boy, this time of year I have racks to dry garlic and onions. So it is quite remarkable. There is it looks like his garlic and onion is drying inside. Bill is. All did great, but the Lord suffered witch broom, but still produced very large cloves. Yeah, it's an interesting name for that phenomenon. So it's kind of a resprouting of the bulbs, and it's not a true witch's broom in the sense that it's and you know what triggers that? You know, I don't know, but sometimes you don't get these really perfect cloves when that happens. I mean, the cloves begin to re-separate, but you know, it's all perfectly good. It may not keep as long, so you might want to use those a little more quickly than you would have otherwise. Lortz keeps longer than others. Lortz is one that I've recommended because it does a lot of years. It does pretty well. So Bill and Mobile is Thai Fire, Thai Purple, Blossom Lotus, and Lortz Italian. And all did great, but the Lortz suffered witch's broom, but still produced very large cloves. And just beautiful to see them drying there in the house. Drying garlic is one of the challenges in a humid climate, and it's not an insignificant challenge. So you want to put it in a place where it's getting as much air circulation as possible. That's really important, so that it dries and you can keep it. A lot of times it'll get rot around the root system if it doesn't dry out properly. Some people cut the roots off, which is a challenge, I admit. But if you've got any like good sharp head shears, you can cut them off with those head shears. And some people leave the tops on. I would leave the tops on just until they begin to turn brown, and then I would begin cutting them off because they too tend to absorb moisture and draw it into the bulb. I've just noticed that. I think the bulbs do better when you don't leave the stem on for too long a period of time in a humid climate, particularly if you're leaving your garlic outside. If you're leaving it inside in the air conditioning and it's an artificial environment and the humidity is low, I think you've got a lot more choices. But, you know, many of us live with other people. If you know what I'm saying. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it presents some challenges in terms of whether or not you dry your garlic inside. There you go. Let's see. Good morning, Dan and Sims. Can you identify this vine? Dan, I would have loved to spend, it's one of those things where I got so lost in answering your question, I thought, you know, I'm going to forget to come back on the air. It happens sometimes. Happened last week. Phil and I were talking about it. I goofed up. And I got to thinking about, oh, here's a good question. I need to answer this question better. And lo and behold, boop, I missed my cue. This happens. Forgive me. But it's all because of you. So Dan sent me this great picture of a flower that I want to be able to identify, and it's tough, and I need to do a better job of being able to identify these. It's one of the native morning glories. It is a morning glory. It's a native morning glory. I'm pretty sure it's not a convolvulus. I'm pretty sure it's an epimoea, which is the same genus that from which we get sweet potatoes. And we got a lot of species in that genus. I'd have to look more closely at the flower parts, and I was trying to think of, is there a quick way I can do this? Just looking at the general outlines of the flower and the leaves, and I can't. I can't. I'm working on it. But it is a native morning glory, is what it is. I'm not sure which one. Not sure which one. I don't think it's a native bindweed. If I get some time this morning, I will try to look it up a little better. There's a bunch of them. And sometimes you have to see details that means I gotta blow the picture up and I gotta look, and it can be tricky. So, and sometimes I just can't because I can't see those details or I can't measure something. All those things can happen. But I'm going to try to figure it out because it's fun for me to figure out these native morning glories. There's some really interesting ones. There are some invasive morning glories as well, and they can drive you crazy. They can absolutely drive you crazy. It's weird how we do this. We have these great native plants that are just beautiful and stunning. Big, beautiful flower, like Dan sent in. And then we bring in this weedy stuff, like European morning glories, and it just makes our life miserable. I don't know. Tough to figure out. What else we got? Somebody has noted 4 o'clocks are sometimes sold as Marvel of Peru. I have never heard, you know, I see it in books. I never heard Grandmother Grace call it a Marvel of Peru. I have heard her call them 4 o'clocks. She had them. You know, it's like when I was growing up, everybody had 4 o'clocks. It was the thing. It was the thing. There were 4 o'clocks at, you know, my grandmother's house, Ingall's house, as we called her. She had 4 o'clocks. I don't know whether she planted them or whether my granddaddy planted them or whether my mother planted them when she was a little girl, but there were 4 o'clocks there. It was a thing. And they're kind of cool. I like 4 o'clocks. I think they're kind of interesting. They're a South American plant, obviously. Maybe Central American too. I'll have to look it up. But they're neat. They survive well. They're slightly weedy. In other words, I wouldn't put them real close to something else that was precious. But give them a little bit of room, because they're going to spread out from seeds and other things. And they're kind of a neat plant. They don't like really wet soils. I'll have to say that. They like a drier soil. They're going to do better in a drier soil than they do in wet soils. So one thing to think about if you're doing that on the Gulf Coast. And the thing I'm thinking about is that in just a few minutes, David Hubble's calling in. And we got lots to talk about. David, I got a list here. I I'm putting them on my fingers. I'm writing each one on my finger so I'll remember. So we've got to talk about, we certainly need to talk about black cherries and black cherry bounce. We're going to talk about melaton, that great, wonderful Gulf Coast squash. David, we're going to talk about thistles. I think we're going to talk about cicadas. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I'm going to get on here with David Hubble. We're going to have a good time talking in just a minute. I want to answer some of your questions really quick. Mr. Plott sent me a picture of a fern. I don't think that's a native fern. I'm just going to give you a caution. I'm pretty sure that's one of the invasive Asian ferns that's begun to take over a lot. It's kind of a nuisance in Mobile. There's a bunch of fronds there. I think they're all the same. And the fronds I'm looking, if assuming they're all the same, the fronds I can see most clearly appear to be the invasive frond. I'll give you the name of it if you're curious later. Let me also say that somebody sent me a picture last week. I successfully identified a picture of wild lettuce. David Hubble, maybe we put that on our list of things to talk about, too. It was wild lettuce, Lactuca canadensis, and it's a little bitter, but it's used medicinally. And it's in fact, is related to the lettuce we grow in our gardens, but not something that you just throw in your salad without thinking about it. You'll have a little bit of a shock. But next to it is a plant that is quite good in salads, I'm pretty sure. Let's wait for it to flower, but I'm pretty sure this is what it is. It's called rattlesnake root. And don't let the name throw you off. It's Stachys, and it is actually related to a French delicacy. It's virtually identical to a French delicacy called a croune or something like that. David, say it for me. C-R-O-S-N-E-S.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, when we're by the way, if you were going to pronounce it in Louisiana, it wouldn't sound like they were pronouncing it in French in Paris. It is good French too. It's just different French. So, right. So that is it, and that's another story. It's quite edible, but let's wait for them to flower. I'm pretty sure that's what it is, and it is very, the roots are delicious. I love the roots. And it's essentially a French delicacy. It's almost the same species. It's Stachys, is the genus. Stachys floridanus is the one that we have. S-T-A-C-H-Y-S, Stachys. Maybe a name you've heard before. David, good to have you. I apologize to David because David sent me a message last week, and last week was crazy insane. And so I'm apologizing to David in front of all of you because he said, look, I'll come on. And I ignored it. I didn't see it, actually. I was busy. And then this morning I said, oh, David, please. So he's jumping on, and this is great. David Hubble, folks. Longer presence on our show. He's always writing me to keep me on the straight and narrow as we talk about things. David is David's family heritage is in Louisiana, and he's living in Mobile. But he has become our authority on native Gulf Coast foods. Particularly those used in Louisiana, and the way people think about food in Louisiana and how they cook them, even if the food is not native. And David and I have had many fun discussions. David has a website called melaton.org, and we'll have to spell that for everybody, David, when we get a chance. It's about understanding this almost forgotten Gulf Coast fruit, chayote, coyote, merlaton, however you want to pronounce it. David has become a real authority in that and has become a sort of a central person in reintroducing that. And so we have a lot of fun talking about various native Gulf Coast foods. David, we have so many things to talk about. You better pick. You start. So what do you want to talk about first?
Well, I guess considering the fact that I think it was two shows ago, you had a lot of people calling in asking you about melaton. And I kind of thought it would be a good opportunity to kind of give everybody an update. When I started calling in, I don't know how many years ago it's been, there didn't seem to be a whole lot of people that were interested or knew about melitons. And I think in the last, I don't know, I'm going to say at least 5 years, maybe 10 years, the folks along the Mobile area, Baldwin County, have really shown up with a lot of interest. And I've been growing the the heirloom variety that I got from Louisiana in my yard for 13, 14 years now. And especially the last few years, I've been able to get some out to folks in Baldwin County and Midtown Mobile, and they've been doing really well. And so, you know, the other thing is that working with melitol.org, MIRLITON.org, with Dr. Lance Hill, that was founded in New Orleans. You know, folks who have the ties to New Orleans and South Louisiana are probably more familiar with it. And like you described it, you'll look in the grocery store and you'll find a chayote squash kind of in the, I guess, Latin American sections, or there usually maybe only a handful of fruit there. But to grow them along the Gulf Coast, you typically will see fresh heirlooms around October, November through December, and maybe occasionally now in May if you have an older vine. But most of what you find in the stores, as we warn everybody, is either from Latin America, Mexico, Costa Rica, Puerto Rico, and people make a mistake of oftentimes planting those, and they're the same fruit but different variety, so they don't do as well here and rarely make fruit. So we have found through the work that Dr. Hill's done, there's at least 16 or so identified plants of different varieties, anyone from the white. These are pear-shaped, light-green, but we've got some that are white, and also some that are spiky and dark green. So we've got at least four varieties in Mobile, or I should say South Alabama. We've got the Boudreaux Robert that I brought in, and we got that here in Baldwin County. We got the Israel Thibodeau, the white ivory colored ones that I have a friend growing, you know, along Dog River here. He's a master gardener. Those get to be a little bit bigger than the one I had, and we had saved that one from extinction a few years back. And then we got another white one called the Bogalusa White, which is very similar. Got a friend of mine growing that in the Spring Hill area. And then a lady in Pensacola has a community garden, and they had success with a Papa Sylvestre is the name of this variety. It's a big green one. So we've got those in Baldwin County and Clark County and Washington County and in Mobile County. So we're hoping that we really take off well with the melitol, so that all the folks who are interested in getting the heirloom varieties can try them out in our area.
Yeah, and it's a Caribbean. It is a Caribbean vegetable, and it's native to the Caribbean and Central America, and it's widely grown. But it's always fun to remember that Mobile and New Orleans were at their core Caribbean cities, and probably still should be.
Yeah,
we're part of that. So much of Caribbean culture was very influential along the Gulf Coast, and it's a shame when we forget it. Certainly, Mardi Gras is part of that Caribbean tradition. But the melitol does not do well in Birmingham, I have to say. It's not an Alabama vegetable. Nothing wrong with, you know, what you can do in Birmingham, but you just got to know that melitol's not going to do well there because it flowers so late in the year here, and we have a long enough season along the Gulf Coast that it works, but it doesn't work when you don't have a long enough season. It's why you won't hear about it in New England. It's why Publix will never sell something called melitol. It'll always be about something they import from Brazil or wherever else. So it's kind of just a Gulf Coast thing and something to cherish. And you said that you were beginning to get some melitol fruit. You think it's going to shape up?
I actually only think I got one that has shown up. I got a lot of male flowers initially about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and a few female flowers. you know, for those who listen, they know when you have one vine, it'll produce both male and female, just like a cucumber or a squash plant does. And I had one, or I had three or four that I thought we were going to take, but I only got one that is probably going to go to a full-size picking. So I'm a little disappointed here in my yard that, I guess, I don't know if it's too much shade or with all the rain we had, if I knocked loose some of the flowers. But folks in certain parts of South Louisiana are getting some of the some on their vines now. So we are seeing some good spring crops.
Yeah. Well, this is just getting fun. So we're going to come back and talk about this a little more. Going to take a break.
Sure.
David Hubbell talking about Melaton, talking about Gulf Coast Foods. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
So, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday Morning. David Hubbell and I are having a great time talking about various things. I'm getting some other questions, and some of them are important. So I'm going to interrupt us, David, just a second to talk about. Deborah had a question about a tree. Deborah sent me a picture of a tree, and Deborah, as nearly as I can tell, that's a weeping zelkova, Z-E-L-K-O-V-A. It's one of these nasty trees that we introduced because people in Boston lost their American elms, and we didn't lose. It's just insane. I don't want to get into it, why we're doing something as weird as planting zelkovas down here. But zelkovas produce a ton of pollen. If it's I would think the pollen season was over for zelkovas, but I don't know. But it looks to me like weeping zelkova, Z-E-L-K-O-V-A. It's distantly related to elms. It's from somewhere way over there. Eastern Europe, I think, somewhere over there. I don't recommend them. I think American elms are so much better and so much nicer, except that everybody, you know, nobody knows they everybody thinks they live in Boston, and where American elms have a problem with disease. Native American elms on the Gulf Coast do not have a problem with disease. I'm not going to go down that road too much farther, but I'm going to let you think about that zelkova, and we'll try to figure out more about why you're having such a reaction to it, which is really interesting. A question from David from Banana Boy before I forget. Banana Boy asks, how's Dr. Lance Hill doing nowadays, David?
He's doing fine. He's actually relocated to Kansas, where his family's from. And so he's kind of manning the ship from up there. And but he's doing well. He had a little bit of a health issue a few years back, but he's doing good. So he's directing, he's still writing a lot of articles on melitons, and a lot of the challenges we received last year with the heat and the heat dome, you know, we're really advocating things like shade cloth. So he's kind of getting on to that, where he's able to laser focus on that now, versus where I try to, but then I get deterred on a couple other different side projects I'm working on. And but he's very active. So if you join the website or the Facebook page under the same name, spelled the same way, he engages in there pretty much daily, several times a day. So he's doing well. So I'll pass that on that people are asking about him.
All right, good.
The comments, you know, I was going to just add to what you were talking about, location and growing them outside of the Gulf Coast. There are a lot of varieties that we have found, even like in California, in the coastal areas, and even coastal East Coast, they have different varieties that seem to actually do well. And but it seems like you have to be in those kind of, what do you call it, the little climate, different kind of ecosystems that allow, even though they get cold and freezing, you may have to treat them as an annual or something, and you have to maybe take special precautions, and your yield may not be as great as what we get along the Gulf Coast when we have a good year. So if anybody is listening to the show outside of the Gulf Coast area, which you may need to find if you're near a coastal area, is find out if anybody's growing them out there and find out what varieties they're doing, because what we have here may not be suitable for other locations, just as the Latin American ones don't seem to do as well, just even along the Gulf Coast.
So I think what you're saying is, so let's back up just a second to explain to folks that there's a daylight sensitivity issue for
right.
melaton, and like many central subtropical plants, more than tropical plants, but subtropical plants in particular, poinsettias are a classic case. They tend to initiate blooming in response to changes in day length, and
right.
in particular, from our perspective, shortening days. Actually,
correct.
What they're responding to are lengthening nights, and mm-hmm. but it all comes down to the same thing. And so they won't start blooming until days are what, around 13 hours?
Right.
No. Is that right? Yeah, that's about right.
Well, it's, you know, like the equinox, the spring and fall, you know, September and March.
Yeah, and so you're getting these short days, and that's really important to initiate flowering, and they won't flower otherwise. But what, David, it sounds like what you're suggesting is that we have now, is that some people have developed melatons that may not be daylight sensitive. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, no, I was thinking more along the lines. There's still, I hadn't looked at it from that perspective. I just know that when we have seen people reach out to us from like California and even Germany and such, that they have
right.
claimed that they're growing them up there. But it seems oftentimes like the climates that they're growing them in aren't as harsh as, say, further inland.
Right.
You know, so
no, that's
like
right.
The coastal areas. So I don't know whether it's the coastal climates, or I don't know if you get any more reflective light from the, you know, being near the coast. So, but that's a good question. I'm not sure how that the light, the longer day or shorter days affect them. But I would imagine that all plays a factor. My point was just simply that, you know, a lot of, like, you had a caller 2 weeks ago asking about growing them. I don't remember if they were in Boston, but. Or going back to Boston, but you just, if you're interested in trying to grow them, you know, like I said, don't try to get anything from down here. Try to see if there's anybody close by where you're living
that's had success,
and see if you can figure out a way to do it. But it's a lot of effort once you get past the Gulf Coast. I mean, it's a lot of effort on the Gulf Coast, but it's a lot of effort really to freeze
yeah.
protect and you pollinate and all that when you get further away from where we're at.
Yeah, yeah. So, melaton, really good discussion. I got to ask you about your black cherry mounts.
Mm-hmm.
Have you started work on it?
Well, I started work on only in the fact that I picked the cherries.
all right, well, that's a good start.
Yeah. You and I have talked for years now. I've been on a quest to find these native black cherries, and I've had a few leads. And then by luck, 2 years ago, I just happened to be walking along the back edge of my mother's yard that she's been there for almost 25 years. And I just noticed the tree was down. And then as I looked at it, I realized it was a black cherry tree had just fallen. But it was kind of, you know, 3 or 4 feet into a wooded area, so I never went back there. So I started picking them. I made my first two batches 2 years ago, and they turned out really well. And I've discovered that the first weekend and second weekend of May, or the week leading up to Mother's Day, is where you really need to start looking for them, at least along the Fairhope Mobile area. I'm sure further north you get, you're probably seeing these native cherries maybe putting on now or ripening now, in fact. So I'm not sure how much, you know, if you go further down the coast in South Louisiana, if they've already, you know, whether that moves up to late April or not. But I picked probably about 4 cups. And these are like little BB size, well, a little bit bigger than BB size fruit. And they're dark red to purplish in color. And they're really pretty.
Yeah, and you know, we have to say, because we, again, our names are very limited when it comes to dealing with plants here in the South, because we come from places that don't have a big language for diversity, as I always remind people. So we call these black cherries, and you could easily confuse them with the black cherries that they sell at Publix, which are, right, in fact, a big fat, I don't mean to use the word fat, but they're big fat.
Yeah.
Cherries that are very different and that don't have the same qualities as our native black cherries. It just can't be used for this. You know, I don't recommend using them in the same way. Our black cherries are dense with flavor, though. They are intense.
Yeah.
Intense. And really rich, tart.
Mm-hmm.
Tart's fair, right? Sweet the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And but just a really intense experience. Not like blackberries. You know, blackberries are, you know, wild blackberries can be a little tart and sweet, but there's something else to black cherry that is sort of, I don't know how to describe it. It's a flavor that I associate too with black walnuts, which is a sort of a rich, wild, almost, how do I describe that flavor? Earthy.
More
earthy. I hate to use the word earthy because
not dirt.
The world is earthy, but it's much denser and darker, and it's mm-hmm. a cool flavor. Now, David, what are you going to do with these black cherries?
Well, I was going to probably go ahead and make another thing of cherry bounce. A friend of mine from the John Folse's Boucheries, he reached out. He was in Belchase, and he was kind of interested in getting together and doing it. And either we're going to figure out a place in between, but the cherry bounce, I can describe it quickly, but you can also find a more detailed recipe that I put together on a video on my YouTube page under David J. Hubble, H-U-B-B-E-L-L. And basically you get an economy type of bourbon for the, you know, bourbon, household bourbon, not something fancy. I wouldn't go with one of the high-end bourbons, but they used to say just get an inexpensive bourbon, and you would take your cherries and you fill them and you rinse them, clean them, dry them, put them in a bottle. Then you cover them with an appropriate amount of sugar, which I detail in the video. And, I mean, you layer them in between. You have sugar and a granulated sugar and the cherries, and then once you get it covered, then you add the bourbon back to it, and in some cases, you go about a half inch above the solid level there, put a little mesh on top of it so that it vents, and you shake it up every week, or I can't remember if it's every day or every week, but you shake it up to keep that sugar and natural yeast that are in on top of the fruits to interact, and you'll go from the white brownish bourbon color to a deep, rich liquid, and it'll have the intense cherry smell to it. And then about 6 months in, you'll go and you drain the cherries out. And by then, all your sugar has dissolved and reacted, and you get rid of the solid cherries, strain it, put it back in the bottle, and you're doing all this in a cool, dark place. And then you keep it down there up until about Thanksgiving, and then you break it out and serve it in little shot or cordial glasses and celebrate the holiday season. So it's a traditional recipe going all the way back to, we know it's George Washington.
Yeah, so we always get, just as we're getting interesting. So we're going to be right back. We're going to be right back with David.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. We've got David Hubble on. I wanted to extract everything I could from David Hubble, just like I am trying to. David's trying to extract everything he can from those black cherries in his black cherry bounce. David, if people were looking for a non-alcoholic experience with black cherry. I still think the alcohol probably helps to extract some of the flavor, don't you?
Yeah, I believe so. Because I, you know, there's been a lot of comments as far as people talking about, I didn't know you could eat those things. And of course, we've talked about the seeds have a certain amount of, I guess, cyanide or something in them. But
well, so do apple seeds and so do peach seeds.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And that's the point you made before, is that, you know, it's like a lot of those a little nugget of information gets extrapolated off that it's, you know, you'd have to eat a lot of those and such. But the part is that with these, they're more seed than they are fruit, a lot of cases. And so people will make wine, again, which is also alcoholic. But I've also heard people will just simply make a jelly with it. Which I haven't tried yet,
right.
Because usually, I mean, I'm kind of, since this is my only second opportunity to collect them, I'm going to, you know, keep making the bounce until I have an abundance of bounce where I can play with the other recipes. But,
right.
You know, if I had, you know, for my jelly making days, what you would still do is you'd extract the juice from the cherries. And then once you have, I can't remember if it's like 4 cups, but you would just follow the jelly, like the sure gel or the Certo recipes with the equal amount of sugar and fruit juice and make your jelly from that. And I bet that would be really good, and I'd like to try that if I have an opportunity one day.
Yeah, and a syrup, a black cherry syrup would be really good, and oftentimes syrups are really well extracted. So it's, you know, a lot of things that we use, including vanilla, typically is extracted with alcohol, but small doses. And sometimes that alcohol helps to make a tincture that can be very useful in pulling the flavors out of the fruit, maybe more than boiling. And I don't really know whether boiling or an alcohol tincture is best for black cherries. I suspect both would work, but maybe for different reasons and for different purposes. So black cherries, it's a great harvest that we forget about that is really abundant. And black cherries are not that uncommon, even on the Gulf Coast. My good friend George down in South Mobile County had a black cherry fall on his property, and we don't often think about how cherry wood is from black cherry. So when you're looking at cherry furniture, it's all from this beautiful black cherry, and we don't think about it growing on the Gulf Coast, but this was beautiful wood. It fell in a hurricane, cut it up. Mm-hmm. He made a beautiful, beautiful table out of it. I had asked him to do that. It's a serving board would be a better term, and it can make really great wood as well. But the fruits are really good, and it's too bad that we don't really pay attention to them. One of the many fruits along the Gulf Coast that we just tend to ignore. Great.
It looks very similar to the elderberry, too. If people are more familiar with what an elderberry looks like, it can be almost confusing. But there's a little difference in how they grow. So.
Yeah. And elderberries are wonderful, too. And we'll have to have a discussion about them. David, I want to come back to thistles.
Okay.
Can we talk about thistles for a second?
Sure.
So one of the nice things is thistles are edible, and people say, are you kidding? And I say, no, you're eating artichokes, and artichoke is a thistle, and it's been cultivated to produce an extra large flower, but there are a lot of artichoke relatives from Europe that don't depend on the flower that are also eaten. Quite commonly, and part of the cuisine there. But we've talked about eating thistles along the Gulf Coast. And is that mostly that there's a tradition of that in many in Louisiana and elsewhere, the native thistles? Are these, and you know, I'm trying to remember our conversations, were these mostly people who were using the stems? Were they using the roots? What were they doing?
So what we would do, what I learned about a couple of years ago, was they use the stems of these big, what they call bull thistles. And I think you really see them, at least along the Gulf Coast, more prevalently, I guess, like early March through April. And they just pop up all over. And I found when I tried, I found one on the causeway. And they are very thorny. And so you need some either gloves. But what they would do is they'd get the ones, you really should get them a little younger, so maybe 3 or 4 foot up. You'd get them. Kind of what they do is take like a sharp knife and they just kind of peel them out in the field. So while it's still kind of up, you can kind of peel it carefully to get all the thorniness off. And then you basically are left with a, you know, cut the ends off. It's a hollow tube, very similar looking to celery. So like a celery would be half. Imagine if you had a full circle
right.
of celery. And you cut them up into little discs, put them in a salad, salt, pepper, some granulated garlic, and some olive oil and vinegar, or oil and vinegar of your choice, and they just make a little salad. And oftentimes they would either, sometimes even eat them while they were out in the field as a snack. With, of course, I don't think they had the olive oil and vinegar with them, but you know, they just kind of would peel them and cut them up and eat them. So I didn't know about it until about 10 years ago, and I started trying it, I think, 4 or 5 years back, and it's really pretty good. I would like to have more access to them than I have.
Yeah, so it is interesting. A lot of our native thistles are not as common as they used to be, and people have tried to get rid of thistles. There are some invasive thistles as well. I don't know how often you see those on the Gulf Coast. I think mostly what we have on the Gulf Coast is native. I think the ones along the causeway are probably the one, Circium horridus, I think is actually the Latin name. It's very thorny, but it's not thorny on the stems. The leaves are thorny. And whereas some of the thistles that are invasive, they're even thorny on the stem and are a little harder to deal with. But we have some really great ones in Alabama. Circium discolor, I guess is what would be a good common name for that. Giant thistle. There's another one called Altissimum, which is also giant thistle. And the Altissimum has almost no thorns on it whatsoever. So I'm going to try the stem on that one this year and the roots. I have a feeling that the flowers can be used too when they're very young. So I'm going to play with those and just see how they do. David, describe the flavor of the. Have you tried these on the causeway and describe
right.
the flavor?
Well, to me, it was very much not quite as pronounced as a celery flavor, but it was very crunchy, very pleasant. So to make a nice summer salad, I think some people even maybe kind of, I don't know if pickling is the right term because they are pretty sturdy. But I imagine that maybe marinate is a better word. You could probably marinate them for, a day or two, and they would probably really absorb that marinade flavor. So that'd be nice as part of, like you did an antipasto tray or something like that, or just this little side salad to put on your salad maybe. That's about the best I can describe it right now.
Yeah, that's really cool. And
I know
so
we talked
just
at, to, go ahead. I know
yeah,
we're at the end.
Ahead.
I was just going to say, I know we had mentioned at one time about maybe it would be a substitute for celery and in early gumbos, but I just wanted to mention that I did make an old gumbo from 1878 that was just okra as the thickener, and it's pretty amazing. So let's talk about
cool.
that some other time.
Yeah, good. Look at this. We had way too much fun, David. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Show's over. We'll have to do this. We're coming back. We didn't even talk about cicadas. All right. We'll be back.
Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard.